everybody, it's Clark, and it's time for Tech Podcast number 321. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Radio in Boston. You can find out more about the program at theworld.org. All right, so Tech Podcast 321, as you can probably imagine, is going to be dealing entirely with the dramatic events that have been unfolding in Japan over the past week. I'm recording this Friday morning, March 18th, just so you know and have a timeline as to where and when my information is coming from. You may very well be listening to some of this, and it may very well be outdated by the time you listen to it. Things are moving very fast, and so my job here is to try to give you the things that I've seen and heard during the week that can help you make sense of what's going on. Of course, this all started a week ago with a devastating 9.0 earthquake off the coast of Japan. It was quickly followed by a tsunami. If you've seen any of the footage of that, you know that it was incredibly dramatic and horrific. That's the only word I can use to describe it. What Japanese officials now are dealing with is a huge humanitarian disaster. Thousands of people in the north of the country without homes, sleeping in shelters. The roads have been wiped out. It's hard to get food, clothing, shelter, tents to them. And of course, we're dealing with a situation at one of the country's nuclear plants, which has also been unfolding over the last few days. So like I said, Friday morning, here we are. Japanese government and nuclear officials say they've still not succeeded in finding a way to stabilize the nuclear fuel rods at the stricken Fukushima plant north of Tokyo. That was the plant that was badly damaged in last week's earthquake and tsunami. Now, a number of different methods have been tried. They've tried to pour water on them with helicopters. They've tried spraying them with fire hoses. What they're really trying to do is to reconnect a power supply to the plant to get its own pumping system back online so that they can cool those reactors and that nuclear material back down. Despite several days' efforts, nothing so far has totally worked. Today in Tokyo, the Yukio Amano, the director general of the International Atomic Energy Agency, said today, reiterated, tried to drive home the point that this is an issue not just for Japan to tackle. He urged all the people of the world to cooperate with Japan on this. Again, from what I'm reading this morning, strenuous efforts continue to try to stabilize that nuclear plant, the Fukushima nuclear plant. Reports of a white smoke, vapor rising over the facility again this morning. No immediate indication of what's causing it. Engineers have been trying to lay down new electricity cables to the plant. Like I said, what they want to do is to get the electricity back online so that they can restore water pumps to keep the fuel rods from overheating, the nuclear fuel rods from overheating. Otherwise, doses of radiation could be released into the atmosphere. Now, at a news conference this morning, Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yukio Adano, reassured people about the levels of radiation.
Relatively speaking, as a whole, radiation measurement has not been serious enough as to have health effect, although some readings are high, but these values are not the ones that pose direct human threat today, but this all depends on other conditions. Environmental monitoring, conditions monitoring will continue in order to conduct detailed analysis.
So we've seen a number of attempts made over the past week to deal with this problem. There was a really good interview that the BBC did just this morning with Patty Regan, professor of physics at Surrey University in England. And they asked him for his assessment of all the methods that have been tried over the past week.
Well, it's been a very emotional week, up and down, I think, for the people. I mean, from a human point of view, it's impossible not to watch those scenes and not be touched by them. And it will reignite the debate of the usefulness or not of nuclear power in the UK and worldwide. There's two schools of thought. My personal school of thought, rightly or wrongly, is that I think this has actually showed that nuclear power, in the worst sort of case environmental disaster you can have, sort of passes the test. But other people would disagree, I'm sure, strongly with that.
And as a scientist, watching the work that was carried out,
well, I think that they've done a remarkable job in the conditions that you can see. What we can't see, of course, from here is what the infrastructure looks like on the ground. to do any sort of engineering there is remarkable, I think, to basically get pumps in. And the fact that they can actually get pumps and could pump water in and could manage to at least get some level, retain some level of control with the eyes of the world looking at them continually, I think is a remarkable human effort.
Why was it necessary to bring in electricity to keep pumping seawater? They were using seawater earlier.
I don't know exactly, but I suspect the issue was that when the fuel rods that were in the storage pools lost their water containment, then the amount of gamma radiation, which is actually attenuated or stopped in the water of those baths, would have increased significantly. And that would have meant that the engineers would have found it very, very difficult to get too close to those reactors. So it's possible that inside the reactors themselves, the radiation is attenuated by or stopped by the walls of the reactor. The stuff with the fuel rods in, the storage pools with the fuel rods in, the attenuation is stopped, or the gamma rays are stopped by the water itself. So I suspect it was as simple as that. When they lost the water from the cooling rod pool, they couldn't get close enough, so they had to bring in extra electricity to stop pumping the stuff around. But it is worth pointing out that the seawater has gone through continually, so those reactors are cooling.
Why were they using helicopters?
I don't know, it's speculation, but I suspect they couldn't get close enough to the cooling fuel rods because of the gamma radiation dose. So a very simple way to cure that is to basically pick up a load of water and dump it all on the top, fill the swimming pool again, and if you fill the swimming pool with water, then that attenuates the gamma rays and you can go back in and work in there.
How brave, then, are those who are carrying out this work?
Incredibly brave, obviously. I think, apart from the fact that there may be some concerns about the level of radiation they're getting, although that can be quantified, just working in those conditions and that pressure and worrying about their own families there is pretty remarkable, actually.
Are you sure that at no time the reactor vessels themselves were damaged or in danger of exploding?
No, I'm not sure. I'm 8,000 miles away, but what I can see, what I observe here, is that the main reactor vessels themselves seem to be mostly structurally intact. There's no obvious holes in the top, and the levels of radiation that we hear about coming out at the site, they fluctuate. They fluctuate and increase when there's a release of gas, basically, from the reactors. But the fact that they're not continually spewing out enormous amounts of dose means that the vessels must remain intact.
And if the electricity is connected and continuous pumping can now take place, and so the cooling is continuous too, what then?
Without trying to sound too flippant, hopefully the situation is then manageable and under control. The only real issue here is if the heat rods, the fuel rods, are not cooled. If they're cooled, there should be no release of radioactivity at all.
So are they on the right track? Well, the BBC did this interview with Matt Tuck, who is a nuclear safety consultant.
There's certainly a futile effort in terms of the reactors, and that is partly because of the damage that's been done, but also because of the configuration of the reactor.
Yeah.
So
this was the business with the helicopters. I mean, it looked, even to the untrained eye, pretty farcical.
I know. And even if they had been able to direct it more accurately, you know, it's not really the way of getting water into a reactor. There really aren't the channels for it to naturally percolate through the reactor. If I didn't know better, I'd say it was almost a PR exercise.
How much faith should we have in the people who are handling this crisis if that's what they're resorting to, something that nearly the eyes of the world look at it and say, well, that ain't going to work?
Well, you know, as you say, the layperson can take a view on that and see that most of the perhaps 70-80% of the water was missing target anyway. It's a very difficult one because they were at a point where they need to cool a core and they have limited means of doing that. Of course, the means of doing that is to inject water into the system, which is the primary cooling. If once your system of actually pushing that in fails, then you're stuck.
Right, so are we talking about a rescue mission that started badly but has now got back on track?
It's certainly back in the direction you would want it to go. I would say we're in the very early stages of that.
But overall, how do you think the Japanese have handled this? Because it's been going on for some time now, isn't it? I mean, there's been a series of explosions. I mean, no one would wish this kind of crisis on anyone, but do you think they've responded properly?
I think given that it was actually, rather than a crisis management team, it was a plant operator team who are trained in emergency response. All nuclear power plants train in emergency response. What they have done so far, certainly in the first instance, has been a fantastic effort. And really, these efforts recently, they could have been futile, but they have limited options available to them. The only other options are the likes of the Chernobyl response of dumping solid material on top of the reactor. And, of course, when you start doing something like that, it's a reversible process.
But there has been a lot of criticism, hasn't there, about this whole approach of actually having the plant operators dealing with the crisis and rather than a specialised, dedicated crisis team?
There is, but in terms of the exposure, you do need those people on board because they do have that local knowledge, and it's a very old plant. They don't have this sort of plant in the US. We don't have them in the UK. Nobody has them in Europe.
Again, nuclear safety consultant Matt Tuck. So let's hear a couple of other perspectives on this. This is a discussion that the BBC had. Here we go.
Will any of these efforts to prevent a nuclear disaster work? And there is another question. Should the power station in question have been shut down long ago? We can speak to Professor Lawrence Williams. He was Her Majesty's Chief Inspector of Nuclear Installations in Britain for many years. And also our environment analyst, Roger Harabin, joins us. Let me start with you, Professor Williams. Thanks for being with us on World Update. How do you ensure the safety of a plant like this in an earthquake zone?
Well, you design it such that it can withstand the earthquake, which is what it did. What it failed to do was withstand an enormous tsunami. After the earthquake struck, the protection systems worked, the chain reaction was terminated in all three operating reactors. The emergency diesels came on because of the loss of off-site supplies to keep the circulation of the cooling water to remove the residual heat within the fuel. And then, unfortunately, this huge tsunami overtopped the tsunami defences and basically flooded the system, which took out the emergency diesel generators. And then the Japanese workers at the site were faced with how to keep the reactor fuel cool with no pumps, no circulation system. And I think given that we've seen no sustained release of radioactivity, we've seen unfortunate hydrogen explosions and some spikes of radioactivity usually resulting from those, we haven't seen sustained release, which means that the emergency systems that the Japanese technicians have been able to put together to pump seawater in is obviously doing something which is maintaining the fuel within temperatures such that there hasn't been significant degradation of the core.
Right, well, I'll ask you in a moment if that's the situation that's going to remain. Roger Harabin, you've been watching how this affects the nuclear ambitions of countries around the world. It has changed the future of nuclear power.
Yes, it has called it into question, Dan. And just to go back to what we were hearing there from Professor Williams, I mean, I think other people would dispute his account that the nuclear plant had withstood the earthquake. The tsunami comes with the earthquake, and therefore it's a question of definition here, I think. At the time when the plant was built and commissioned, Japan was experiencing less seismic activity than it is experiencing now. So it does call into question the abilities of the authorities to predict exactly what earthquake-proof might be. And we also have the other issue of I don't think we know either for sure that the plant actually withstood the earthquake either, because there have been a lot of unpredicted problems with cooling that were not to do with power supply. We've also seen the fire in number 4 with the cooling rods, and there is speculation that perhaps the earthquake knocked them over and some of them were damaged in when they were knocked over. So I think it's too early to say whether or not the plant itself actually withstood the earthquake. And questions like these are now being asked around the world. I don't doubt for a minute that I'm sure other nuclear power stations will be built, but people will be questioning detailed design, especially in countries which have earthquake risk.
Well, let's check on one of the details with Professor Williams, because one of the things that's said is that later designs are passive in their cooling. They don't require the pumps. In other words, if the power goes out, you still keep things cool. But what seems to be the problem is they're getting plenty of water in, but it won't stay there.
I think the issue there is that at Fukushima at the moment is that because they haven't got the main electrical supplies or didn't have for the last 5 days to circulate the pumps, they've had to vent the system. to prevent over-pressurization, because what you want to do
is... But as I say, they don't seem to be able to keep the coolant in there. For example, with the spent fuel rods that weren't being used for power generation, that seems to be the greatest problem, because those are, we're told, now completely exposed.
Yeah, that's a different situation, in the sense that the fuel storage pond has suffered, you know, a couple of fires, which has, I think, by the looks of it, taken the outer building out of, just destroyed that outer building. And there's conflicting reports, because I can only sort of respond to what I see, you know, on the websites and what I see, you know, on BBC News, etc. I've got no detailed information as to exactly what happened during the earthquake, sure, in terms of the sort of things Roger's just been mentioning. But if the fuel, if the water in the pond has evaporated, then what we need to know is how much fuel was in that pond. Was it relatively old fuel? Was it new fuel from the
Sure. So that is another problem, isn't it? That we don't seem, and the people of Japan seem not to be getting the information that they require. That's why a lot of them are leaving. Look, we'll have to stop there, I'm afraid. It's fascinating, and no doubt there'll be plenty of other opportunities for getting your expertise. Professor Lawrence Williams and Roger Harabin, thanks for being with us.
Of course, this has serious ramifications for the use of nuclear power around the globe. Let's hear a couple of different perspectives on that. Again, this is from the BBC This Week.
Fukushima fires and explosions have spread radiation, and that's caused concern in many countries around the world where nuclear power is used. Australia has said all nationals with non-essential roles should consider leaving Tokyo. The areas most affected by the earthquake and tsunami should also be evacuated too. French citizens living in Tokyo have been urged to leave or to head to southern Japan. Germany is taking its oldest nuclear power stations offline following events in Japan. So is this a turning point for nuclear power? Ingrid Nestle is a member of the German Parliament, energy and economy spokesperson for the Green Party. Ian Fels is Emeritus Professor of Energy Conservation at the University of Newcastle in the northeast of England. He runs his own consultancy. And both of you, thanks for being with us. May I start with you, Ingrid Nestle? What do you believe is the future of nuclear power?
Well, I do think that the events in Japan are a turning point in the history of nuclear power. And up to now, there was always the story around that an accident like this cannot happen in highly industrialized countries, that it cannot happen in, yes, countries like Japan and Germany and UK and France, that is simply impossible, that there is a rest risk which will never, never happen. And we now see that this story is not true, and that catastrophes like those in Chernobyl 25 years ago can repeat themselves in all places of the world, which means we have to move out.
Well, it may not be wise to put these plants on fault lines in earthquake zones, but that's not the case in Germany, is it?
Well, we do have earthquakes, although not the same strength, but our power plants are not built for such strength of earthquakes, so there is a certain risk. But this is not the main point. The main point is that the story, these things are safe, has been proven wrong in a very high technology country.
Let's hear from Professor Ian Fels now, then. Do you understand that people are very nervous about nuclear energy at the best of times, and this certainly raises their fears?
Right, it certainly raises their fears. One can see why people are concerned. It's also very difficult to get any real information about what has occurred there. We think we know what's happened with these are quite old nuclear stations. The first was built in 1971. they were designed to cope with earthquakes, but not with an earthquake, and at the same moment a huge tsunami, which made all sorts of problems with their cooling systems. As far as I can see, the Japanese is struggling very hard to keep the thing under control, and everything I've heard during the last 2 days suggests that they are, with a few hiccups, managing to do that. If there is a release of radiation, comparing this with Chernobyl is mischievous, in fact.
Well, it's Chernobyl different, because in Chernobyl, the graphite caught fire. That, yeah, that isn't the same design. It's not going to happen. But on the other hand, you sound very calm, but you know the technology. People don't understand this technology, and it can kill you silently.
Yes, it is a very strange thing, isn't it? I've been in the business for a long time, and even now, people don't know the first thing about radiation and its dangers, except that but they live very happily with the radiation, and they happily have CAT scans if they're ill, or dental X-rays. the kind of release at the moment would seem to be equivalent to a couple of dental X-rays or something of this kind.
Ingrid Nestle, we've heard the calming words from Professor Fels. The question to you and anybody who's opposed to nuclear power is, in a place like Japan, for example, where they have no real natural sources of energy, they have to import everything, what's the alternative? And indeed, in an industrialized country like Germany, what's the alternative?
Well, the alternative very definitely is renewable energies and energy efficiency. Let me give you an example from Germany. Only a few years ago, the Federal Agency for the Environment published numbers that we can save 20% of our electricity without paying extra money. So the money you have to invest, you get it back.
But that is 20%.
That's exactly what we have in nuclear electricity.
Okay. Well,
we can simply move out of
what
nuclear.
What happens, Professor Fels would probably say if I let him, what happens when the wind stops blowing?
Well, when the wind stops blowing, we are building huge electricity grids so we can produce it in another place and transport it. We have big storage capacities. We have some renewables that are always available, like water, like biomass. We can interconnect the different sectors, let's say, that is building, warming, and the traffic sector, and then we can use the storage capacities of the traffic sector as well. For example, we can move some of the demand to demand side management.
Professor Fels, it's easy to dismiss alternative technology, isn't it? I think in Britain, if the wind stopped blowing, we'd have to rely on French nuclear power. But alternatively, it's very dangerous. Perhaps using less is the answer.
Well, certainly using less is a good idea, and the steadily increasing price of electricity, particularly, is going to make people use it more efficiently. But what has just been described to us is what, if you like, the Green Party and other people have been saying for the last 20 years. And it's been demonstrated that renewable energy is a useful part of the mix.
And but it, only a part, you're going
well,
to say.
Well, it cannot produce more than 20%.
That will just about wrap things up for Tech Podcast 321. I did have one of our listeners write in and ask about, what about the use of robots in Japan? Of course, the Japanese, as you've heard on the podcast, especially in the past couple of months, use robots for many things. So the question was sort of, why aren't they using robots there in the control rooms at Fukushima? And it's an interesting question, and it's sort of an ongoing research project of mine. I don't have an interview for you, but I have been collecting some articles that have been coming across, and you can find those on the show notes. So if you're interested in finding out how robots are being used in Japan, they are being used for search and rescue, but they have not yet been employed with the crisis at Fukushima. So if you're interested in that, just go to theworld.org/technology. I've got the story embedded right there with all of the links to all the articles. So you can go and look that up. That's also the place to find links to us on Twitter and Facebook. I'm trying to use Twitter as a way to get out tech news about any sort of tech news that I see about what's going on related to the crisis in Japan. I'm also trying to use the Facebook fan page for that as well. So if you want to keep up on all the latest, stop by, friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We're World's Tech Pod at both places. Alternatively, you can email me at Clark, clark.boyd@bbc.co.uk. Talk to you next week.
Support for the World's Technology Podcast comes from the National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin, nsf.gov, and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org.